You to it. Well, this is focused. The only way I can turn these off is by pulling the plug.
Well, let's pull it, because I can't talk into that. Well, put something in front of it.
Turn these off.
Yeah, just switches in the back.
Switches in the back of what?
Yes.
The lamps?
Yes. Another little down.
Thank you. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're sorry to be starting late because we do have to work on a rather close time schedule, but we can't help it because the luncheon wasn't over quite as soon as was expected. Presumably you are all completely mixed up as to who is who after we've switched the signs here two or three times. I'm going to cut my comments to virtually zero in order to try to save time. Now, in this session this afternoon, we're running into some rather stiff competition. In some of the other sessions where they're talking about pipelines and native people and so on, so I'm delighted to see that as many have shown up here as are present. Fundamentally, this is the group that is interested in the occurrence and the accumulation of the material about which this conference is mostly all about anyway. This is the where it all starts and what is in the ground. Because the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 presentations that we have are within themselves widely divergent, it seems better to have a discussion after each paper rather than at the end of the session. And I will try to budget the time so we will be as fair as possible to each one of the speakers. I had originally allowed about 30 minutes for each, including the discussion. I have discovered that some of the speakers need a little more time, some a little less, and I will simply have to judge that as we go along. Whoever's in charge of the logistics, does somebody tell us when the coffee is ready? Toward mid-afternoon, presumably halfway through or thereabouts. Now, the pedigree of each of the speakers is set forth in some detail in some of the material that was given to you when you registered, so I am not going to take time to make any long introductions either. I therefore believe we can start with the first speaker, George Gritch, of the Alaskan Geology Branch of the Geological Survey, who will discuss the geologic framework of the North Slope Petroleum Province. George, and while you're getting ready, we in front of the screen can perhaps move each way so that we won't be in the way of the projector.
I don't know if all these logistics are going to work here that we set up rather rapidly, but give it a try. Yeah, well, I'll need the... Dr. Reed, ladies and gentlemen, I should mention first that whatever new data is presented here is largely the result of the work of Bill Berger and Irv Tyler, my collaborators, without whose efforts I could only plow old ground. That the Prudhoe Bay field and adjoining areas constitute one of the major oil provinces, certainly of North America, possibly of the world, is now widely accepted. Most experts agree on reserves in terms of billions of barrels. Some speak of 40, 50, even 100, 150 billion barrels of oil in all of Arctic Alaska and like amounts in the Canadian Arctic Islands. Lower figures appear to us to be probable, the upper possible. These possibilities, added to the known reserves of Cook Inlet, the prospects in the Gulf of Alaska, the Alaska Peninsula, Bristol Bay, the Bering Sea, and elsewhere, have fixed worldwide attention on Alaska. To those of us who have been active in accumulating the geologic data that generally precedes such discoveries, and who have been continuously evaluating the potential mineral resources of Alaska, these recent discoveries are not unexpected. However, the magnitude of the possible reserves at Prudhoe Bay has surprised even the most optimistic oil searcher. May I have the, oh, you've got them on, good. Well, here comes the test. Fine, you can see the slides, but I can't see my paper. Well, we'll turn around this way. Although there's no need to introduce most of this audience to the geography of northern Alaska, this tectonic map illustrates rather well the Arctic setting of the North Slope and the close geologic relationship to the Arctic Basin and the nearby areas of Canada and the USSR. Note also the large continental shelf area in white, about equal to the land area of Alaska. At this point, the other slide on the other side was supposed to go on. Somebody want to kick that thing or whatever you do? Fire the other way. So which one are we on there? Well, number two, that's number one. All right. This map illustrates the major physiographic features of the North Slope that we'll be discussing. The Brooks Range, which cuts off the slope from the rest of Alaska. A belt of foothills generally divided into a northern and southern section. And a coastal plain, treeless and dotted literally with thousands of lakes and marshes. And then finally the Arctic coast, low relief, shallow water, and prominent offshore bars. The initial discovery at Prudhoe Bay in 1967 was certainly the immediate result of a forward-looking, fiscally courageous effort by the Atlantic Richfield Company. But the story of oil on the North Slope of Alaska begins at least 50 years ago and includes several chapters of geographic and geologic exploration and an earlier petroleum exploration program that showed the way to the great strike at Prudhoe Bay. It is important to the broad purpose of this conference to review the more significant steps in this buildup of geologic knowledge and exploration know-how, and to review the general geologic framework and environment of the North Slope. This will provide a historical perspective for viewing the present activity and a geologic basis for the view to the future. Oil seepages and oil shales in northern Alaska probably were known to the Eskimo long before recorded history. The early traders reported seeps along the Arctic coast, and these were investigated and reported by Sandy Smith and E.D.K. Leffingwell in 1916. In 1901, Schrader, a geologist, and Peters, a topographer, made the first recorded geologic and topographic survey across the Brooks Range and the Arctic slope. And in USGS Professional Paper 20, they described the structure and stratigraphy along the Anaktuvik and Colville Rivers. E.D.K. Leffingwell began his classic work along the Arctic coast and the Canning River in 1906. In USGS Professional Paper 109, he named and described the Saddle-Rochet Formation, the main oil-bearing formation at Prudhoe Bay, and he described the occurrence and origin of permafrost, a unique geologic feature of polar regions that now poses new and difficult problems to engineering development. In 1921, the Standard Oil Company explored the seepages in the Cape Simpson area and made an effort to stake claims under the old mining laws. However, about this time, oil was discovered in Oklahoma and Texas, and oil in the remote Arctic region was forgotten. Based on the work of Schrader, Leffingwell, and private geologists, President Harding in 1923 set aside 37,000 square miles of the North Slope as NPR 4. Yeah, that's not moving, I guess. The second slide there. My remote control doesn't seem to work. The U.S. Navy then asked the Geological Survey to explore the area, and in 3 years, several traverses were made across the slope. The results, published in USGS Professional Paper 815 in 1930, described the possible source beds, including the oil shales, possible reservoirs, beds, and reported that, and I quote, structural features favorable for retaining petroleum were widespread. This was in 1930. In 1944, as part of the World War II effort, the U.S. Navy began an exploration program to further evaluate the petroleum possibilities of NPR-4, and again the Geological Survey was asked to participate in the geologic aspects. The program was recessed in 1953, and the results are all recorded in a series of USGS professional papers. Many of you are familiar with these reports and the PET-4 effort, and I won't take the time to review this in any detail. However, it should be emphasized that the PET-4 program pointed the way and the feasibility of a modern oil exploration in the Arctic using all of the latest oil finding techniques, including surface and subsurface geology, refraction and reflection seismic surveys, airborne magnetic and gravity surveys, and drilling by experienced oil industry personnel. It should be emphasized also that oil and gas deposits were discovered, and although not of sufficient size to warrant development because of the remoteness, these discoveries provided positive evidence that there was a major oil province in northern Alaska. The program was suspended with the full knowledge that exploration was not complete and that oil prospects had not been tested, or all oil prospects had not been tested within or to the east of NPR-4. Since 1953, the Geological Survey, as part of its long-range objectives and responsibilities, has been mapping the geology and studying the stratigraphy of the Brooks Range and the adjacent foothills, has continued to provide new geologic information and a periodic review of the petroleum possibilities of Arctic Alaska. The latest review, which was the AAPG report on the potential gas resource of the United States, was prepared in 1964, finally printed in 1968. The potential of Alaska was assessed by USGS geologists, and for northern Alaska, north or east rather, of the Colville, Patton reported, and I quote, facies studies of the Triassic and Permian strata in the foothills suggests that these rocks, which are mainly shale and chert in the outcrop, may contain fairly clean sandstones beneath the coastal plain, unquote. Thus, he accurately described in 1964 the upper oil horizon discovered at Prudhoe Bay in 1967. This brief historical review demonstrates how the gradual buildup of geologic information sharpens the focus on exploration targets and also demonstrates the lead time that is frequently required for such discoveries. Turning now to the geologic framework, the North Slope, we have generalized on this map. I'm still not working. Next slide, please. We have generalized on this map the distribution of rock units as we know them from the published work, largely that of USGS. In the broadest terms, the geologic framework relevant to the petroleum possibilities of northern Alaska consists of four major structural belts and two major depositional cycles. The structural belts include the Brooks Range Giana Cline, or uplifted belt of faulted structures, mainly involving thick competent Paleozoic rock units, a disturbed belt of shallow thrusts involving incompetent Mesozoic rocks in the southern foothills of the Brooks Range and the DeLong Mountains. 3, the deep Colville geosyncline consisting of Cretaceous rocks And four, a broad northern regional high comprising the Barrow Arch, the Arctic Platform, and the Romanzoff Uplift. The first depositional cycle, which Tyler has called the Arctic-Alaska Basin, began in the Silurian or Devonian about 400 million years ago and continued into the Jurassic about 150 million years ago. The basin extended across the present Brooks Range well into central Alaska. The northern shoreline oscillated from about the latitude of the present Arctic coast to the range. Near this shoreline, sandstones and other well-sorted sediments were deposited, creating possible reservoir rocks. Organically rich limestones and shales, including phosphatic beds, were deposited offshore to form the possible source beds of petroleum. Early Jurassic to Cretaceous uplift, thrusting, and igneous activity disrupted the older Arctic-Alaska Basin and formed a fold belt in the area of the present Brooks Range and a new depositional trough, the Colville Geosyncline, to the north. Erosion of the fold belt provided a flood first of flish or poorly sorted dirty sediments 2A4 deep along the northern edge of the Colville Geosyncline, and later molasse or better sorted cleaner sediments to a succession of basins progressively moving and filling north across this subsiding geosyncline. The source of the sediments was from the south, opposite to the primary northern source for the earlier depositional cycle. These structural belts and depositional cycles are portrayed on this generalized map and cross-section. Other pertinent detail plotted here include the Meade Arch, which separates the Colville Geosyncline into two minor basins, the Umiat and the Chukchi, the two major anticlinal alignments, which we have shown, of which there are many, illustrate the continuous nature of these trends. The one to the south is the Carbon Creek Aiyuk structure, which can be readily traced for more than 200 miles. And the northern alignment is the Umiat-Umalik-Meade trend, which some geologists believe is the northern limit of the Ducullamont, or the decoupling of the Cretaceous trough from the older rocks. The Colville Geosyncline, as shown in the diagrammatic section, is overthrust in the orogenic belt, interrupted by a sill, and gradually rises. Well, first it steepens to about 20,000 feet in the vicinity of Umiat and gradually rises to within 2,500 feet at Barrow and about 8 to 10,000 feet in the area of the Colville Delta. The basement or pre-Cretaceous rocks in the middle of the trough remain somewhat of a mystery, but in the area of the Romanzoff uplift, or positive tectonic element, and on the Barrow Arch, the Jura-Cretaceous rocks overlie Triassic, Carboniferous, and Devonian in sequence, and these rocks lie unconformably on schists and phyllites of Devonian and Older Age, which are shown here in the pink color. The submarine high, which we have shown off the west coast, is based on magnetic anomaly at about 9,000 feet depth and may represent a basement feature or a younger intrusive. The red line pattern outlines the major granitic masses, and the solid red are the basic igneous rocks. In general, exposed igneous rocks and metallization are rare on the north slope. No extensive metal deposits or occurrences are known. The blue lines, as you probably already have noted, outline the withdrawn federal lands, NPR4, and the Arctic Wildlife Reserve. Also plotted are many wells drilled or announced to be drilled as of 3 months or so ago. The well symbols are conventional. The more important discoveries include Prudhoe Bay, Gubik, Umiat, Square Lake, Meade, and of course Barrow. Many but not all of the other tests in NPR 4 are shown by the four rayed dry hole symbols and the open circles to the east of NPR 4 are the current test wells. Now roughly all of these test wells and discoveries can be grouped first into the 36 tests and 45 core tests that were drilled by the U.S. Navy within and adjacent to NPR 4 through 1952. Then a second group of seven relatively shallow tests that were drilled by the oil companies from 1963 to 65, presumably to explore for other Umiak-Gubik type deposits. And then finally the third group, which began in 1966 with Arco's Susie No. 1, followed by the two wells near the Colville Delta, and climaxed by the discovery at Prudhoe Bay. The next slide, please. Now that should be on the left screen. Oh, I beg your pardon. Let me put it over here. Okay. This chart summarizes the stratigraphic sequences in the eastern and central area. Does not include the far west, where relationships are similar but not identical. The color codes are blue for carbonate, dark green for Church shale, greens for the shale siltstone, yellow for sandstone and conglomerates, and orange for graywackies. All units are shown in their proper stratigraphic relations except the older rocks of the Nurukpuk formation, which is shown in its physical relationship at the bottom to the Baird group. Now the red dots indicate the horizons in which oil and or gas have been discovered. From the top, they are the Gubik gas field in the Tulevac Tongue, the prospective Square Lake gas field in the sandstone of the CB formation, the upper horizons in the Gubik and Umiat fields in the Nunavut formation. All of these are Upper Cretaceous. The deeper Umiat and Mead gas horizons in the Grandstand and Kuparuk formations of Lower Cretaceous Age, the Barrow gas sands in the Jurassic, and finally, the Prudhoe Bay oil sands in the Saddle Rochet formation and the lower oil horizons in the Lisburn limestone. Now, that's a good record for any basin, and there are other possibilities. It should be noted that the section of rocks in the Brooks Range and southern foothills differ from that to the north in some very important aspects. One, the Lisburn group and underlying Kayak shale are older in the south, where they appear to have been deposited on older rocks without interruption. To the north, these units are younger and lie unconformably or at angular relationship to argillites and phyllites that were planed by erosion before the sea lapped northward. Two, Permian through Jurassic rocks are generally Church shale in the south, but normal marine shale, sandstone, or limestone in the north. Three, the Jurassic or Neocomian Cretaceous rocks are graywacky flish or dirty marine and mafic volcanics in the range, very thin shale, chert and coquina in the foothills, and marine shale and sandstone to the north. Four, the lower Albian Cretaceous rocks are also rapidly deposited graywacky flish facies composed of mafic and recognizable Paleozoic detritus in the foothills, and shale and siltstone to the north. The stratigraphic chart and the cross-section on the other screen depict a history of basin filling beginning with the overlap of the Mississippian shale and limestone and ending with the Upper Cretaceous and Tertiary non-marine deposits. There is some suggestion that the marine tertiary deposits exposed at Marsh Creek on the right screen may extend seaward and westward and possibly thicken offshore. The next series of slides summarize our knowledge of the thickness, distribution, and lithology of several stratigraphic intervals, beginning with the Lisburn group of carbonates, 300 to 350 million years old. May I have the next one, please, on the right screen? These maps were prepared by Bill Breger for a special study of the National Petroleum Council. I don't know if I should mention that group after the lambasting they took, and are available to you through the U.S. Geological Survey open file. I'll not discuss these in any detail, but I just would like you to see the general state of our knowledge on this subject. The isopachs, or lines of equal thickness, are in hundreds of feet, and the thickness of the Lisburn group ranges from 0 to 3,000 feet. The available subsurface data are shown by the red circles. Lisburn carbonate is reported to be the lower horizon at Prudhoe Bay. Carbonate is present at Colville Test Well Number 1, and red beds of about the same age are present in the Topargric Test Well. The other well shown is the Cookpuck Number 1. Can be assumed that Lisburn carbonate or equivalent rocks are represented in that test. West of the Colville region, in those areas where on the seismic profiles a pre-Triassic interval is indicated, we have inferred the presence of a facies equivalent to the Lisburn group, but not necessarily carbonate. The blank area to the west is so shown because there are no data, and the disturbed belt bounded by thrust faults is left blank for the most part because the belt is not well known and the rocks are structurally complex. In Canada, on the north slope of the British Mountains, Triassic and Jurassic rocks rest directly on Mississippian argillite and phyllite, and the Lisburn carbonate is missing. This, then, is the zero line of the Lisburn group, and by using the few scattered data in the subsurface, we have extended it along the Arctic coast to Barrow. It is either an erosional interval or an onlap edge extending along the ancient shoreline, which follows roughly the Arctic coast. The next slide on the right screen depicts the Permian and that part of the lower Triassic that makes up the clastic lithologic unit and the upper oil zone at Prudhoe Bay. The control points for the thickness and distribution lines are the unconformity in the British Mountains, where the Permian is missing, the Prudhoe Bay field, the Colville and Topargric tests, and the exposures in the Brooks Range and the Arctic foothills. The subsurface to the west is inferred from seismic profiles within NPR4, and we have left it blank where we have absolutely no data. The lithology of this interval is fairly constant from west to east, but changes greatly from south to north. In the Brooks Range, the Permian Siksikpuk formation is consistently about 500 feet of red, green, and gray silty shale and chert with barite and pyrite. And in the Romanzoff Mountain, the Sadlerochit formation is dark shale, siltstone, cherty siltstone, sandstone conglomerate. The Sadlerochit thins to the north and grades into a fine-grained ferritic sandstone and quartzite interbedded with shale and conglomerate. Similar fine sandstone, chert, pebble conglomerate, siltstones, and shale are present in the subsurface at the Colville and Topargric tests. The sandy petroliferous facies along the north edge of the basin is on the inferred coastal high onto which the Triassic and Jurassic rocks overlap, and like the Lisburn, the Sadlerochit may be truncated or overlapped by Upper Triassic and Jurassic rocks all along the coastal high. We did not prepare isopachs for either the Upper Triassic or for the Jurassic for lack of data and complexity. The oil shales in the Jurassic and Lower Cretaceous have been studied extensively by Tyler and Turtelot, with generous support by the U.S. Navy and the Arctic Research Lab. And although no extensive tonnages can be identified, the richer shales yield up to 145 gallons of oil per ton. And some of the shales contain anomalous amounts of metals, including zinc, vanadium, molybdenum, mercury, gold, and larger than ordinary amounts of arsenic, copper, nickel, selenium, and silver. Now, this next map on the right screen shows the thickness distribution and general lithology of all of the Lower Cretaceous and Cenomanian rocks in the orogenic belt. These are the Okpik Ruok and Fortress Mountain formations, and in the basin, the Okpik Ruok, Torok, and Nanushik group. The color code is the same as on the stratigraphic section. The thickness is in thousands of feet. This slide and those that follow illustrate the gradual filling of the basin that developed north of the Brooks Range during the late Jurassic Cretaceous orogeny. Initially, the basin was deepest to the south, but as thrusting progressed and the basin was filled, the axis of deposition moved north. Now, the next two slides separate the Nanusha group sandy facies from the rest of the equivalent and older rock, but I see I'm running a little long here, so I don't think I'll describe these in any great detail. The first one, or is that the second one? The first one, thank you. In addition to showing the distribution and the sand shale facies, which I won't go into, the black beds in the cross section are coal, which is widely distributed in the West and constitutes about 90% of the coal reserve in Alaska. The next map shows the Nanusha group, which is the sandy facies of the Upper Albian and the time equivalent of the Upper Toorak and the sandy rocks of the Cenomanian. I'll call your attention here only to the yellow, which indicates the 30 to 50% sandstone facies, and the crosshatch lines, which show the more favorable sandy facies. And note that the Umiat field is in this sandy facies on the marine side of the interfingering zone. Presumably, this is the zone in which one would explore for further Umiat or Gubik-type deposits. Now, the last slide on that screen shows the Colville, including the CB formation, which are the rocks that are exposed at the surface. Again, I'll just show this to show the status of knowledge. I won't discuss it in any detail. Just note that the Colville rocks, these are the Younger Cretaceous rocks, are thickening to the east, and some of the thickness, possible thicknesses are given there. Each of the color tints equals 1,000 feet on this slide, and the isopachs are on the CB formation in terms of hundreds of feet. Well, now this is a very brief and likely a very transient look at the geology of the North Slope. I hope I have left you with an impression of a large, complex sedimentary basin that includes good source beds for petroleum, petroleum-bearing zones in at least five Cretaceous horizons, one in Jurassic, one in the Triassic, and one in late Paleozoic. Prudhoe Bay may be the only giant field on the North Slope, but there are certainly many other possibilities for deposits. The major geologic settings which are favorable targets for petroleum exploration include 1, the buried high or shelf along the north edge of the Colville geosyncline, where slightly deformed rocks of both the older and younger cycles of sedimentation may include reservoirs comparable to those drilled near Prudhoe Bay, 2, the eastern uplifted end of the Colville geosyncline, and the flanks of the Romanzoff uplift, where older rocks may be within drillable depth and extensive unconformities may provide traps. 3, the ancient Cretaceous shorelines within the Colville geosyncline, where winnowed sandstones form good reservoirs on structural traps, such as at Umiat and Gubik. And 4, the structurally complex southern edge of the Colville geosyncline, where older rocks are present at or near the surface. Now, the geology of the North Slope would not be complete if I didn't at least mention again the word permafrost. The subject deserves separate treatment, and some aspects of it have been or will be discussed by other speakers in this conference. Realizing the tremendous importance of permafrost to the North Slope oil development, the Geological Survey has prepared a summary report on the subject, which was published on July 15th of this year as USGS Professional Paper 678. As the other conference speakers have mentioned, this is our contribution to the early warning system of engineering development on the North Slope. The report is written for the layman as well as the engineer, and I recommend it to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George, not only for your very good outline of the geology of the North Slope, but also for your review of the history.
Oh, all right.
Well, maybe for some questions. We'll take time for two or three questions of Mr. Gritsch. Does anyone wish to raise a point?
I guess they're all convinced, John. That's right.
Apparently, your presentation was so compelling that there are no questions. Thank you very much indeed. Our next speaker will talk about petroleum exploration in the North. He is John M. Sweet of the Atlantic Richfield Company in Anchorage. Mr. Sweet. You have nothing in the way of slides. Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Do you want the other lights out too?
I think that'll be fine.
All right.
Dr. Reed, ladies and gentlemen, my assignment for this panel, although not global, did leave me much room for imagination. Petroleum exploration in the North as a subject gives one adequate room in which to maneuver. This polar projection covers the northern hemisphere from 60 degrees north latitude. And I think you can see on here the bluish color are the known shield areas, and presumably the rest of the area is prospective for exploration for oil and gas. The area which I directly have been concerned with the last couple of years is this very small red area here in northern Alaska. Although my experience in this total area is somewhat limited, I have almost 9 years of experience, mostly in Alaska, some in Canada. This experience might further be defined as an association rather than a deep personal day-to-day involvement. In other words, I'm no expert. I think the title of this brief presentation would have been more meaningful had its locale been the Arctic or subarctic rather than simply the North. I hope I don't disappoint you too much when I say that the most profound thing about exploration in the Arctic is the fact that there is nothing really profound about it. Insofar as I'm able to determine, industry is using the same proof techniques which it used elsewhere or uses everywhere else in the world. This is not to say that everyone is not diligently working on new ideas and techniques which we continually hope will give us that elusive competitive advantage which we all would like to have. I will avoid discussing the special requirements in the field of logistics or the problems presented by the environment or terrain. These sometimes present monumental problems, but they are disciplines unto themselves and do not affect the basics of exploration in the Arctic. The efforts to date and those which will continue into the foreseeable future have been so basic and straightforward to exploration people that I'm reluctant to mention them, but perhaps I'm being too blasé, and they may be of interest to many of you who are farther removed from the proverbial forest and trees. In any new province, an explorationist will obtain his information wherever he can, and invariably, this is some form of surface geology, usually from the government, but frequently bought, borrowed, or traded for competitors, or again, frequently self-generated. The relative ease and success of this technique is directly related to the quality and the extent of the outcrops. The good or the poor extremes are as follows. A good area will have sufficient outcrops to reveal a marine sedimentary sequence that is conducive to the generation, migration, and storage of hydrocarbons, and sufficient surface mappable structures which might reasonably be expected to cause traps. Active hydrocarbon seeps in the area would provide direct evidence. At the poorer end of the spectrum would be the frontier area in which there are only limited outcrops. They may do no more than indicate the presence of a sufficient sedimentary section which may be projected into the subsurface, such as George described. I believe it is safe to say that industry has proceeded with oil exploration in the Alaskan and Canadian Arctic, beginning from both of these endpoints. Obviously, there are all kinds of combinations in between these two examples. An obvious one is the surface structure with sufficient outcrops to map an anticline, but without sufficient stratigraphic sequence exposed to estimate the potential stratigraphic thickness of the petroleum potential of that sequence. Although these important factors may be missing, no explorationist that I know could turn his back on an enticing structural situation. It is obvious also that the departure from these two extremes would determine the speed or delay with which one may begin drilling. Regardless of the success of the early exploratory drilling based on the various subsurface geologic techniques, geophysics will follow. If I said subsurface there, I meant surface. Usually the first survey will be the rapid, relatively low-cost tools of airborne magnetometer and gravity meter. These are done frequently in cooperation in a cooperative group effort. Following this will be the reconnaissance and ultimately the detailed seismic programs. The drill follows, but not always with the immediate success, because projections from surface outcrops do not always stand up for as great a distance as we would like, or because the proper parameters and chronology for generation, migration, and entrapment of oil are not in the proper relationship, or finally, because of the occasional fallibility of the seismic tool. This nearly always can be attributed to poor record quality or unexpected and unpredictable lateral and vertical changes in seismic velocity control. Following the inevitable early drilling failures, we begin to employ the techniques of subsurface geology from our monuments to science. The geologist will now begin to improve his interpretation, having learned more about the lateral continuity of the stratigraphic units, source, and reservoir rocks. The geophysicist will be able to begin building a velocity gradient map, which will enhance his overall mapping effort. And he will make synthetic seismograms from which he will be able to identify more accurately his reflections. Usually a well-reasoned and executed geological and geophysical exploration program will culminate in success. It has been my experience that perhaps half the time, the controlling factors of an accumulation of oil and gas will in some substantial way be different than the reasons or parameters which originally led an explorationist into a given area. For example, a well might have been originally drilled to test an anticlinal trap, but have inadvertently, for some unexplainable reason, probably because of velocity changes, have drilled and discovered a trap that could be better described as a permeability trap. It seems to be more common to drill a well expecting production in formation L, but to find major reserves in formation S. In conclusion, I would say simply that the basic background information by the USGS and the discovery of oil by the Navy at Umiak erased a lot of the doubts about the potential of Arctic Alaska for industry. The first wave of activity, and this is repeating what George said, was attempted to extend what the Navy had already found, that is the relatively shallow Cretaceous accumulations on fairly obvious surface structures. That program failed. The next wave of activity concentrated on Paleozoic objectives, presumably on seismic structures because there are no obvious outcrops where the other wells were drilled. And lo and behold, look what happened. Following the deeper, inevitable dry holes, oil was found, but not in the Paleozoic objective, or at least one that was considered the main objective, but in Mesozoic rocks that do not have significant amounts of oil anywhere else in North America. I would say this about what's going on in the Arctic insofar as I'm concerned now. The wells are being probably more thoroughly evaluated with complete suites of logs, cores, both sidewall and full hole cores, velocity surveys and velocity analysis, and the complete spectrum. We're throwing the complete package at all of the wells so we will know precisely what we have as we begin our development program of these fields. So be it. Exploration is really no different in the north than it is most other places.
This paper is open for discussion. We want to thank you for your lucid putting into perspective of the various stages of oil exploration. Are there some questions? Warren?
I have a question. You're related by something you said. Why is it that the Arctic continent is so discovery was in a geologic formation that was unusual and a first? Does this open up new horizons?
I'm sure that it does. I would say that it opens up great new horizons, particularly in the Canadian Arctic. And you saw on this little slide the tremendous area in Siberia. The Russians, I'm just guessing because I know nothing at all about Russian geology, but I would guess that they would have lots of running room there.
With reference to the United States proper, though, and the older oil fields in Texas, I'm not a geologist, but I'm curious, does this open up a new horizon of possibility?
Well, I'm sure that that's the thought that went immediately to everybody's mind, but again, I am afraid I'm too provincial in my geology of the United States to answer that. I imagine George or one of these other people could answer that, but I believe that I'm not sure.
Is there any planning existing that you know of that consists of generating electricity from petroleum resources on location without any refining or processing? Either just for the base camp or for extension to Point Barrow and Wainwright at lower cost than the generation itself?
There are no plans like that that I know of. If there is going to be a topping plant there that they will make fuel that they will be able to use in generators, diesel generators, and I'm sure also turbines, and there's gas there that can be used in gas turbine generation, but right now there are no plans for using it outside of the immediate area that I know of.
Well, is there any feasibility study of generating electricity at such a low cost that communities could be established within the proximity of the wells, the gas wells, let's say, that could operate entirely from all electric convenience?
None that I know of. I'll add this as an or something that's interesting to me. So I'd like, we've found that electrical heat up there, you would think almost automatically, even if you have to haul a few in, that would be tremendously prohibitive from the cost standpoint of expense. But we've found that electric heat in camps is the way to go. Not necessarily the most economical, but when you consider the safety aspect, why it's a fine way to heat your camps.
Why isn't it the most economical without any qualification?
I don't know anything about electricity.